So last time we covered a whole bunch of new ideas, and it was really quite a lot of ideas for one class. Here's some of the ideas we covered. We talked about information sets, and these were ways to allow us to model imperfect information. So what's imperfect information? It's a way of being able to capture both simultaneity in moves and sequential moves in the same game. So it's a way that's going to allow us to meld the lessons from before the midterm and after the midterm. Then we talked about what strategies meant in this context, and the basic idea is strategies are instruction. A strategy for each player gives them an instruction at each of their information sets. Then we talked about what subgames were, and leaving aside the technicalities, subgames were just games within games. And finally, we introduced the idea of subgame perfection, which is our new solution concept that refines the idea of Nash equilibrium. And what subgame perfection is going to do is it's going to instruct the players to play a Nash equilibrium in every subgame. Another way of saying it is, a subgame equilibrium is a Nash equilibrium in the whole game, but in each subgame, it induces Nash play as well. All right? Now we're going to see today examples. If we have time, I'll go through three different examples, and I'll tell you at the end of each example what it is I'm hoping to be the takeaway from that example. All right, so last time was a lot of formal stuff. Today's going to be a lot of examples. Okay. That's our agenda. Here's a game. Here's our first example. And I call this game Don't Screw Up, for reasons we'll see in a minute. All right, so this is a game in which player one has to choose between up and down. If player one chooses up, then player two gets to move and chooses between left and right. And if player two chooses left, then player one gets to move again, and player one chooses between up or down. All right, everyone looking at that game? So why don't we play this game, since we haven't played a game for a while. We'll play a couple of games today. So what I'm going to do is, let's divide the class in two. So if I just draw a line down the middle of the class, okay? Everybody to my left, to your right, everybody over this side of the class is a player one. Okay, you're all player ones. All right? And everyone on this side of the class, you're player two, including you guys hiding from the camera. All right, you're player twos. All right? Okay, so let's figure out what we're going to do. Right, everyone have time to look at the game? All right, so player ones, you get to move first. Those of you who are going to choose down, raise your hand now. Raise your hand, wave in the air. Keep it up so the camera can see you, okay? And those of you who are going to choose up, raise your hands. All right, lots more ups. Those of you who chose up, why don't you all stand up? Why should I? I don't want to do all the exercise here. So all those who chose up, stand up. All right, so you can see that choosing down ends the game. So this many people are still playing the game, all right? Everyone who's still sitting down, everyone who's sat down here has exited. All right, player twos, you get to move now. All right, so player twos, those of you who choose right, including the people on this aisle, those people who choose right, raise your hand now. One right over there. Those of you who choose left, raise your hands. All right, why don't you guys all stand up? Just to get you awake on Monday morning, right? Everyone's sleepy otherwise. All right, let's go back to player twos. Let's go back to player two. All right, so those of you who are still alive, sorry, player one, those of you who are still in the game, so those of you who chose up the first time, how many of you now choose down? Raise your hand if you choose down. And raise your hand if you choose up. All right, just to get a sample of this, let's get the twos to sit down again so people can see them. So twos sit down. All right, those of you player ones who are still in the game, who are choosing up, raise your hand now. All right, I think it's everybody. Is that correct? Okay, you can all sit down, okay? Okay, so let's just talk about this game for a while and then we'll analyze it. Now this is not a difficult game from the point of view of stuff we've done since the midterm. It's pretty clear what we should do in this game by backward induction. So why don't we start there? Okay, so by backward induction, we find that if player one gets to move a second time, then they're choosing between four and three, and they're going to choose four. All right? And player two, if they get to move, knowing that player one is going to choose up tomorrow, they're going to be choosing between three if they choose left, or two if they choose right. So they're going to stay in the game and choose left, which is what most of you did. All right. And finally, player one at the beginning of the game knows that player two is going to choose left, whereupon she's going to choose up. So if she chooses up, she's going to end up getting four. And if she chooses down, she's going to get two, so she's going to choose up. So it's clear what backward induction does in this game, and that's what most people did in the game. Is that right? Is that right? However, not everybody did it. Some of the player ones, actually, when you raise your hand, those are people who chose down. The ones who chose down, there are more than that because you didn't all stand up. Those who didn't stand up just now, raise your hand. People are hiding now, but it's okay. Those people who chose down, they may have had a reason for choosing down, and their reason for choosing down might have been that they thought that even though they can do backward induction, so even though they know that by backward induction, up gets them the better answer, they might be worried that if they choose up, player two will screw up and choose right. And notice that if player two chooses right, then player one only gets one, whereas down yielded two. So in some sense, down was the, quote, safe thing to do for player one, given that they might be worried that player two might screw up. Right? Does that roughly just nod if this is the case? For those people who chose down, is that kind of what you were thinking? Some people are shaking their heads, but some people are nodding. That's a good sign. All right? All right. Now, why might player two, in fact, screw up and choose right? Because player two might themselves think that player one might screw up at this stage. If player one were to screw up at the last stage and choose down, then player two, by choosing left, would only get one, and for him, the safe option, therefore, is right, which yields two. All right. So to get the backward induction answer here, which most of us did, relies on player one trusting player two to play backward induction, and that requires player one to have trust in player two, trusting player one not to screw up at the last stage. So say it again: player one needs player two not to screw up, and that means player one needs to trust that player two will trust her not to screw up. All right, everyone, see the game? Okay. So let's try and analyze this game using what we learnt last time and see what we find. So the first thing to do is let's look at strategies in this game. So player two has two strategies, left and right, because player two only has one information set. And notice this game is actually a game of perfect information. Right? This game is a game of perfect information, so it's going to be very easy. Player one has two information sets, this information set and that information set. At each of them, player one has two choices, so she must have four strategies in all. All right? So this game, when we put it in its matrix form, is going to be a 4x2 game. Here it is. And the strategies for player one are up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And the strategies for player two are just left and right. And now we can put the payoffs in. So up, up, left gets us 4-3. Up, up, right gets us 1-2. Up, down, left gets us 3-1. Up, up, right gets us 1-2 again. We end up exiting the game here. Down, up is easy because it's just exiting the game at the first stage. So all of these are going to be just 2-1. Okay, we're happy with that. Right, so all I've done is translate the game into its matrix form. And let's look for Nash equilibria in this game. All right, just look for Nash equilibria. Let me do it at the board since it's quite easy at this stage. So to look for Nash equilibria, let's just worry about pure strategy equilibria for now. All right, so if player two was choosing left, then player one's best response is the up-up strategy. And if player two is choosing right, then player one's best response is either down up or down down. That's exactly the conversation we just had. If player two was going to, quote, screw up and choose right, then player one wants to get out of the game immediately. All right? Conversely, if player one is choosing up up, then player two is happy and is going to choose left. He's trusting player one. If player one was going to choose up down, however, then player two, that's player one screwing up at the second stage, so in that case player two wants to get out of the game and choose right. If player one is choosing down up, then player two is actually, that doesn't matter, they're indifferent, and if player two is choosing down down, then once again, player two is indifferent, since they don't get to move at all. All right, so from this we see that there are three Nash equilibria. Let me call them 1, 2, and 3. All right, so one Nash equilibrium is up, up, left. Another Nash equilibrium is down, up, right. That's here. And a third equilibrium is down, down, right. Down, down, right. All right, so there are three pure strategy Nash equilibria in this game. And let's just see what they do. So the first one, up, up, left, is up, left, up. So it gets us to here. All right, so this one is the same equilibrium as corresponds to backward induction. Is that right? This one's the backward induction equilibrium. And the other two are different. Down, up, right, and down, down, right, both end up down here, exiting the game immediately. Right, so both of these other equilibria fail backward induction. So let's put backward induction with a line through it. Right, they're failing backward induction. All right, and so you may ask, why are they equilibria? Well, we've seen examples like this before. For example, in the entry game, we also saw examples last time. So in this game, the reason these are equilibria, even though they fail backward induction, is exactly coincides with that conversation we just had about worrying about the other person screwing up. All right, so in particular, if player one thinks that player two is choosing right, that is to say, thinks that player two is going to screw up, then player one doesn't want to travel up the tree because she knows she'll be carried down here, and instead she just chooses the safe option and gets two. Right, so from player one's point of view, if player two was going to choose right, then getting out of the game, doing the safe thing, is the best response for player one. And from player two's point of view, if player one's exiting the game, it really doesn't matter what player two says she's going to do, right? Because she doesn't get to move anyway. All right, so that's why these are both equilibria. Okay, so what we want to do next, we've translated this into a tree, we've written down the strategies. We want to actually see which of these Nash equilibria are subgame perfect. Which of these Nash equilibria are subgame perfect? All right, let me give myself a bit more room here because I want to keep this in sight, so let's get rid of this. And raise this one. All right. So the next question is, which of these three Nash equilibria are subgame perfect? All right, to do that, we need to start by identifying the subgames. And of course, having just hoisted that board up there, I have to hoist it down again. Okay, so what are the subgames here? Well, the simplest subgame is this simple subgame at the end in which player one moves. All right, that's a very obvious subgame, is that right? That's a little game with a game. It's a rather trivial game because it's a one-player game, but it is a game. So let's examine that one first. That's the last subgame. All right, so the last subgame here is a somewhat trivial subgame. It looks like this. Player one is the only mover, and they're choosing either up or down, and the payoffs are 4-3 and 3-1. And frankly, we don't really care at this point what player two's payoffs are, because player one is the only person who's playing in this subgame. All right, but nevertheless, let's put them there. And if we write this up as a matrix, here it is as a matrix. It's player one is the only mover. They're choosing between up and down, and the payoffs are 4-3 and 3-1. And of course, player two doesn't get to move, so player two is irrelevant here. And clearly the only Nash equilibrium in this game, is for player one to choose up. Right? Player two, it doesn't really matter what they choose. There's nothing they can do about it anyway. But for player one to choose up is the Nash equilibrium. So the Nash equilibrium in this trivial sum game is one just chooses up. Is that right? So let's look at the play induced by our three candidate Nash equilibria in this subgame. All right? So each of our candidate Nash equilibria, here they are, this one, and this one, have an instruction of how player one should play in this subgame. And let me just pause a second. The reason that these three equilibria have an instruction for how player one should play in the subgame is because of our definition of a strategy. Each strategy tells the player how they should move at every information set of every information set of that player. So even if the strategy is such that that information set won't be reached, the strategy still has to tell you what you would do when you got there. And now, for the first time perhaps, we're going to see why that redundancy helps us. All right? So let's look at the instructions. Each of them gives an instruction. The first one tells us to play up in the subgame. First one says up. The second one says up again. And notice this was redundant, right? Once you've chosen down, you know you're not going to get to make a choice at the third node or your second node. But nevertheless, there's the instruction, and it says up. Right? And the third one says down. All right, it says down. So this is the instructions of these three equilibria in this little subgame. Right? This is the play prescribed by these three equilibria in this subgame. All right, two of them say up, and those ones are going to induce the Nash equilibrium in the subgame. But the third one does not. The third one says down, and that's not allowed. That's not allowed in a subgame perfect equilibrium, because in a subgame perfect equilibrium has to prescribe play in every subgame that's Nash. And here, the third equilibrium is telling player one to choose down, which is not a Nash equilibrium in the subgame. All right? So what are we doing here? Let's make it clear. We're finding the subgame perfect equilibria, and what we've done is number three is eliminated because it induces play in this subgame that is not Nash equilibrium. Not a Nash equilibrium in the subgame. All right, we're already putting stuff together now. This really used, to be able to draw this conclusion, we really used the fact that strategy three contained a redundant instruction, an instruction down at this node that was never reached. But that helped us get rid of it. All right, so that one's gone. Three is gone. All right, let's proceed. I'm going to run out of board space here. Have people got this one down? People got this down? All right, I'll bring it back in a second. Almost. Let me give it a second. All right. What I want to do now is look at the next subgame. All right. Maybe what I can do, if I just remove this comment, I can work on the right-hand board. That'll allow you just to look at it. So all that comment said was three is eliminated. And let me work now on the right-hand half of this board. That'll allow it to be up there a bit longer. Okay. So let's now look at the next subgame. And again, we're going to work from the back. So the next subgame back is the subgame that starts from this node. All right, the subgame that starts from that node. All right, so let's identify that in a different color. I use blue, so let me use pink. So now we're going to look at this subgame, this big pink subgame. All right, and again, in this pink subgame, this game looks like this. It starts with player two choosing between left and right, and then player one has to choose up or down, and the payoffs are 1, 2, 4, 3, and 3-1. All right, once again, let's look at the matrix form of this subgame. And this is a little bit less trivial than the last one, because now there are really two players playing. So here's the matrix that goes along with this. Player one is choosing between up or down, and player two is choosing between left or right. And this is slightly cheating, because in fact, player one, of course, knows what player two is going to have done by the time she moves, but never mind, it'll do for now. All right, and let's put the payoffs in. So up left is 4-3, and down left is 3-1, and up right is 1-2, and this must also be 1-2. All right, everyone happy with that? They're just putting the payoffs in. And let's just look again just at pure strategy Nash equilibria here. Okay, there are actually mixed ones, but let's just worry about pure ones for now. All right, so the pure Nash equilibria here in this little subgame are what? Well, let's just see. If two chose left, then one wants to choose up. If two chooses left, then one wants to choose up. If two chooses right, it doesn't really matter what one chooses, because she isn't going to get to move anyway. All right. Conversely, if one chooses up, then two wants to choose left. That's the example of one not screwing up, so two wants to stay in the game. But if one was to choose down, then player two would like to get out of the game. So if player two thinks one is going to screw up, she wants to exit the game. All right, and very quickly we can see there are two equilibria here. One of them is up left, and the other one is down right. All right, they correspond to ending playing down this way, that's down right, and up left playing up this way. All right, and once again, let's look at our three equilibria in the parent game. Here's our three equilibria in the parent game. Three. And let's see what play they induce in this little subgame. So we'll do exactly what we did before. So 1, 2, and 3. These are our three equilibria from above. And equilibrium number one, up, up, left, in this game prescribes up, left. Is that right? And equilibrium number two, down, up, right. Down, up, right, here prescribes up, right. And equilibrium number three, down, down, right, here prescribes down, right. So which of these are prescribing Nash equilibria in the subgame? Well, up left is an equilibrium, it's that one. Up left is an equilibrium, so this is okay. And down right was an equilibrium, so 3 is okay in this subgame, all right? But upright is not. Upright is not a Nash equilibrium, all right? So in this subgame, Nash equilibrium number 2, the down upright equilibrium, is prescribing play that is not a Nash equilibrium in the subgame, so it's eliminated. It can't be a subgame perfect equilibrium. So here, 2 is eliminated since it induces non-Nash equilibrium play in this subgame. All right. And now we're done. We know about the whole game. So what we did here, we started with the whole game. We found there were three Nash equilibria. We found that only one of them agreed with backward induction. We then looked at the subgames. We first of all looked at that blue subgame, and we found that one of the equilibria, equilibrium number 3, was eliminated. Equilibrium number 3 is not prescribing Nash behavior in this subgame. Right? Then we looked at the slightly more complicated subgame, the pink subgame, and we found that equilibrium number 2 prescribes the behavior upright, which is not Nash in this subgame. Right? At this stage, we've eliminated two of the three equilibria, and we're just left with one. And the one we're left with the only sub-game perfect equilibrium, the only equilibrium that wasn't eliminated by the fact it would prescribe bad behavior in sub-games, the only SPE is number one, which is up, up, and left. And what do we notice? We notice that that's the equilibrium, that's the play that backward induction would have selected. All right, so notice, this is the backward induction prediction. All right, so what are the lessons here? The lessons here are that our new idea, our idea of subgame perfect equilibrium, is pretty easy to go about finding. You just look at subgames and check that the play in each subgame has to be Nash play. All right, in fact, if you start at the back, you'll construct it by rolling backwards, much like we did backward induction. Right? Start at the last subgame and work backwards. And the second thing is, not surprisingly given that remark, not surprisingly, where backward induction applies, for example, in this game, the subgame perfect equilibrium will find the equilibrium that is consistent with backward induction. And remember, that was our aim last week. We wanted a way of refining Nash equilibrium to throw away those Nash equilibria that were inconsistent with backward induction. So subgame perfect equilibrium has done that. It tells us now, if backward induction applies, the Nash equilibria you should focus on are the subgame perfect equilibria. And indeed, most people in the class played that equilibrium just now. All right? Okay. So that's really all I want to say about this example. But let me just make a remark in passing. I made this mark in the middle, so let me just make it again. When we write down strategies, those strategies tell us what seem to be redundant moves. But being forced to write down those redundant moves is useful, because it allows us to model what other people think you would have done at those later nodes. And sometimes I have to think what you think I would have done at this later node before I decide not to go down that branch of the tree. So being able to write down everything in a strategy allows us to have everything in front of us and makes that analysis simple, and that's exactly what we did here. All right, so this was a fairly mundane example because in particular, we didn't use any kind of information set. So next, let's look at an example that does use some information sets. All right, so new example. Let me clean this off. And once again, I want to play this example, but what I'd really like to do, I'm going to call this game the matchmaker game. The matchmaker game. And what I'd actually like to find out is, do we still have our couple we tried to send on a date, our hapless couple we tried to send on a date in about week 3? Are you guys still here? Ah, there's the guy. What's your name again?
David.
And what was the, is she hiding? Oh, there she is. Thank you. And your name was?
Nina.
Nina and David. Good. Can we get some mics to Nina and David, actually? Let me do it. And I'll go on talking while I'm doing this. That's okay. Where's David?
Right,
thank you. And let me grab him. Ali, can you get a mic to Nina? That would be great. Thank you. All right. So for weeks, we've been trying to get this couple to go on a date. It's our attempt to get economics majors to become real people. It's a hard thing to do. And they're kind of the hapless couple because we send them to the movies and they end up going to different movies. And then we send them off for a romantic weekend in New England and they end up doing different things. And one went to the theater, another went apple picking. I forget which way around it was. And at this point, I figure I'm a pretty bad matchmaker. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a third player into the game as the matchmaker. So first of all, I'll write down what the game is. All right. So the game at this point, the game's going to look like this. Player one is the matchmaker. We can call him player M if you like. And he has a choice. He or she has a choice. She could not send the couple out on the date. Or she could send the couple out on the date. Right? But being a better matchmaker than me, if she sends them out on the date, she's going to stake some money. You know, she'll pay for the date. She'll pay for the date. All right? And in the date, once again, they're trying to meet. And once again, unfortunately, they haven't figured out where to meet. All right? We'll put the payoffs in a second. We'll tell you what the strategies are. All right, so what I'm going to assume here is I'm going to let Jake, our TA, be our matchmaker. And the reason I'm choosing Jake is I think he's the nearest thing I have in mind in this class to being a Jewish mother. I mean, he's neither Jewish. I think he's not Jewish and he's not my mother, but he is the TA who's responsible for bringing me some drink every day in case I pass out in the lecture. So that's the nearest thing I can think of. So Jake's going to be our Jewish mother, and Jake's going to either send these guys on a date or not. And Jake's smarter than me at this. He's actually good at matchmaking. And what he's going to do is he's going to send them somewhere where they really, well, he knows Yale students better than I do, and he's going to send them really somewhere where they're going to meet. So he's going to send them to go to the same lecture class next year, and then they'll be sitting in the aisles in this huge lecture class, and they're bound to meet. All of you have sat next to other people at some point. So you know, that seems like a good idea. So the classes he thinks of sending them to, he says, go to a large lecture class. So they're either going to go to the Gaddis class, or which is called Cold War, or to the Spence class, which is called China. Everyone know about these classes, right? Right? And these seem like reasonable classes to go to meet somebody. I mean, the Cold War kind of fun class. I mean, you hope it isn't a prediction of the future relationship, but Cold War seems all right. And China's, by all accounts, is a fantastic class. It involves, you know, something involving 20 million people, most of whom are in the class, I gather. So it's a pretty big class. So let's do that. So we'll call this Gap. Unfortunately, Jake makes the same mistake I do. He's not going to tell them which class to go to. So they have to decide whether to take Gaddis or Spence. And once again, they're coordinating. We'll call them players 2 and 3. So here they are trying to coordinate. And the payoffs are as follows. So let's put in Jake's payoffs first of all. So if they manage to coordinate, if Jake doesn't send them, everybody gets nothing. All right? And if Jake does send them and they coordinate, Jake makes 1 because he feels really happy about this. After all, I mean, there must be some motivation for people matchmaking. If they coordinate down here, Jake gets 1 as well. But if they fail to coordinate, Jake feels rotten about it, particularly because, you know, he paid for them to go to this class, whatever the cost of a class at Yale is, which is probably quite a lot, actually, I don't know. All right. So, okay, we'll call it 1, though. All right? And otherwise, the payoffs are exactly the same as the payoffs we used when we looked at this game earlier on in the course. So the payoffs are going to be 2-1 here, and 0-0 if they fail to coordinate, and 0-0 here if they fail to coordinate, and 1-2 here. All right, so the implication of this is that player 2, who we'll assume is David, is that right? David. So David would like to meet Nina, but all other things being equal, he'd like to meet her at the Cold War. And Nina would like to meet David, but all other things being equal, she would like to meet in China. I mean, not literally in China, but in the class China. All right, so this is our game. All right, and we're going to analyze this game. But before we analyze it, let's try and play it. So what we need to do is, first of all, let's make sure things work smoothly. Let's have David write down which class he's going to choose, and Nina write down which class she's going to choose. I've lost sight of Nina. Someone needs to point out. There she is. Right, write down what class you're going to choose. Okay. Something been written down? Okay. And Jake, you got your mic there. Sorry, Jake. Are you going to send this hapless couple or not?
So I have Dave in my section, actually, and I hear how much he's been talking about Nina, so I'm going to roll the dice and send him.
All right, going to send him. Okay, good. All right, so we have them going off to this class. All right, and now let's see what they wrote down. So, Dave, what did you write down?
I'm going to give it and go to China.
You're going to go to China, and Nina?
I chose S.
You do? Oh, great, so they managed to meet. So that was a successful date, so let's give them a round of applause, all right? I hear it's a great class, too, and in fact, I don't think it's going to happen forever because I think he must be approaching retirement, so that seems a pretty good choice. So good. Okay, that worked very well. Let's have a look now at this. Let's analyze this game and see what we can do with this game, all right? So how are we going to analyze this game? So no surprise, we're going to use the idea of a subgame perfect equilibrium. All right, I'll collect the mics later, don't worry. All right, so we're going to use the idea of a subgame perfect equilibrium. So how do we figure out how to work out what a subgame perfect equilibrium is? We're going to use the same basic idea that we used it when we've been using all along in backward induction. And it's the same idea in the game we just looked at just now. What we're going to do is, rather than start from the last decision node, you can't do that anymore, and work backwards. Instead of doing that, we're going to start from the last subgame and work backwards. And in this example, it's pretty obvious what the last subgame is, right? The last subgame, the game within a game, there is only really one, the game within the game is this object here. Is that right? This is the game within the game. Now, I could, at this stage, I could do something else. I could write down the whole matrix for the whole game and have Jake choose the matrix and Dave and Nina choose the row and the column, but that's going to take, you know, it's going to get us astray. So we could do that, but let's not worry about that. Let's just start doing things backwards. So when we do things backwards, we'll start at the last subgame, and that last subgame is an old friend of ours. It looks exactly like this. Let's just write it in. All right, so here's, it involves players 2 and 3. All right, and 2 is choosing between Gaddis and Spence, and 3 was choosing between Gaddis and Spence, and their payoffs were, let me leave a space here, so it was 2, 1, 1, 2, 0, 0, 0, 0. So here are the payoffs of the relevant players in the game, but while we're here, why don't we put in Jake's payoffs as well? So Jake's payoffs were 1 here, 1 here, minus 1 here, and minus 1 there. All right, so the only relevant players here are players 2 and 3, but I've put player 1's payoffs in as well, because why not? Why not just keep track of them? Okay, everyone happy that that's exactly describes this little game? All right, for all intents and purposes, we can forget the first payoff, but there it is. All right, and this is a game we've seen many times so far. It's the Battle of the Sexes, or the Battle of Dave and Nina, and in this game, we already know what the equilibria are. So the equilibria here, let me just underline best responses. So if Nina is choosing Gaddis, then Dave chooses Gaddis. If Nina is choosing Spence, then Dave would like to choose Spence, and conversely. All right, so I've just underlined the best responses for the players who are actually involved in the game. I haven't bothered underlining anything for Jake because he isn't a player in this game. That makes sense? All right, so the pure Nash equilibria in this game, the pure Nash equilibria in this game are essentially Gaddis-Gaddis or Spence-Spence. All right? That's pretty easy. All right? And from Jake's point of view, each of these pure strategy Nash equilibria yield a payoff of for him of what? What does he get? If they go to Gaddis-Gaddis, he's happy that they met and he gets 1. And if they choose Spence-Spence, he's happy that they met and he gets 1. Jake doesn't really matter. Jake himself doesn't really mind whether Dave and Nina learn about China or learn about the Cold War. He just wants them to meet. All right. So both of these yield 1 for Jake. Both yield a value, let's call it, a value of 1 for player 1, who's Jake. All right. So from Jake's point of view, going back a stage, what we're going to do now, just a bit with backward induction, we're going to roll the game back. So we started by analyzing this subgame, and now we're going to roll back a stage, just as we did with backward induction. So when we roll back, Jake is moving here. If Jake chooses not to send them, then we get 0, 0, 0, but the key part of this is the first 0, that's Jake's payoff. And if Jake sends them, then what Jake gets is the value to Jake, value to player 1, okay, value to Jake of the Nash equilibria in this subgame. Right, rather a big thing to write, but that's what Jake gets. And the others do too, the others get that as well. And in this case, rather than writing that long piece, this is just equal to 1. Is that right? Right. So if Jake sends them, he knows that they're going to play a Nash equilibrium in this subgame, or he believes they're going to play a Nash equilibrium in this subgame, and either of those two Nash equilibria in the subgame, either of the two Nash equilibria in the subgame yield a payoff to Jake of 1. All right. So actually, one of them is one. One of them yields payoffs of 1-1-2, and the other yields payoffs of 1-2-1. But since Jake is the only mover here, let's just focus on Jake. All right. So from Jake's point of view, he's really choosing between 0 and 1. So he's going to choose send. All right. So the Nash. So the subgame perfect equilibrium. The subgame perfect equilibrium. Therefore, there are actually two of them here. One is send Spence. That's what actually happened. But there's another one, which is send Gaddis. Right, that would also have been a pure strategy subgame perfect equilibrium. Right, so in either case, what we did, just to remind ourselves, we first of all solved the equilibrium down the subgame, the equilibrium in this blue subgame. We figured out how much that equilibrium was worth for everybody, but in particular for Jake, but for everybody. And then we rolled that payoff back and looked at Jake's choice. Right, in this particular case, that gave us two equilibria, send Spence, and send Gaddis. However, some of you must be suspecting at this point that there's actually another subgame perfect equilibrium here. Right, how do we know that? Well, just think about this game. I mean, we've been trying to send this couple on a date all semester. They haven't gone on a date all semester. I'm embarrassing them now, but they haven't gone on a date all semester. So there must be some possibility that they would fail to coordinate. And it would be a pretty weird notion of equilibrium that concluded that they always manage to coordinate, and hence Jake always wants to send them. Is that right? So let's also look at the other equilibria here. Now, the reason there's another subgame perfect equilibrium in the whole game is that there's another Nash equilibrium in the subgame. What's the other Nash equilibrium in the subgame? They could mix, right? So it turns out that in the subgame, here it is, there's also a third mixed equilibrium. There is a mixed Nash equilibrium. All right? And we know how to work that out. We could write down a P and a Q, and we could look for those in difference conditions and solve it out. But this is a subgame. This is a game. This subgame corresponds to a game we've seen many times in this class so far, and I think we probably remember what that equilibrium is. Is that right? I do anyway, so let's see if you remember it as well. I'll write it down, and we'll see if you all look alarmed. So I claim the equilibrium, the other equilibrium, has Dave playing with probability 2/3, 1/3, and has Nina playing with probability 1/3, 2/3. Right, so this is another equilibrium in the subgame. People remember that this was an equilibrium in Battle of the Sexes, yeah? Yeah, people nodding at me, yeah? Okay, so it isn't too unintuitive. We all know how we'd work it out. We could go back and put in the P and the Q, but it isn't too unintuitive. It has Dave going more often to the lecture course that he would prefer, all other things being equal. And it has Nina going more often to the lecture course that she would prefer, all other things being equal. And they do so in just such a way as to make each of them indifferent. All right. Now, this subgame induces a different value for Jake. Right? So suppose Jake thinks, I trust Dave and Nina to play a Nash equilibrium in their subgame, but I don't know which one it is, and I think maybe they're going to play this one. All right? So suppose Jake thinks that this is the equilibrium that Dave and Nina are going to play. So now, should Jake send them or not? Well, let's work it out. So now, if he sends them, if Jake sends Dave and Nina, or more anonymously, if player one sends players 2 and 3, all right, then with what probability will they meet? In what probability will they meet? Well, this is just a little math exercise. Let's have a look at the game again. So Dave is playing 2/3, 1/3, is that right? And Nina is playing 2/3, 1/3. All right, is that right? So the probability of their meeting is the probability of this box, they could meet at Gaddis, plus the probability of this box, they could meet at Spence. Is that right? So the probability of this box is 1/3 times 2/3. So this box has probability 2/9. And the probability of this box is 2/3 times 1/3. So this probability this box has probability 2/9. So the probability of their meeting is 2/9 plus 2/9, that makes 4/9. All right, everyone okay with that? All right, so if Jake sends Dave and Nina and they play this mixed strategy equilibrium, then they meet with probability 2/9 plus 2/9, 2/9 at Gaddis, 2/9 at Spence, for a total of 4/9. All right, which means they fail to meet, and hence fail to meet with probability, well, if they're meeting with probability 4/9, what must be the probability that they're failing to meet? 5/9, thank you. So they fail to meet with probability 5/9, all right? So Jake's expected payoff, if he sends them, the value for Jake of this equilibrium is what? So the value to Jake of this Nash equilibrium, if he sends them, is 4/9 times 1 plus 5/9 times minus 1 for a total of minus 1/9. Everyone okay with that? All right, so if Jake sends them, they fail to meet 5/9 of the time, and he gets minus 1 each of those times. They succeed in meeting 4/9 of the time, he gets plus 1 each of those times. So his expected payoff, his expected value from sending Dave and Nina on the date is minus 1/9. All right? So from Jake's point of view, what this game looks like, if he thinks that this is the Nash equilibrium being played, if he doesn't send, he gets 0, and if he does, he gets the value of this Nash equilibrium, which in this case is minus 1/9. So he's not going to send. All right, and the SPE here is not send, mix. All right, where this is the mix. All right. So there's a third equilibrium here in which our matchmaker says this hapless couple is just too hapless, they're going to play the mixed strategy equilibrium, in which case it isn't worth my while sending them on the date. You guys were lucky because Jake chose the other equilibrium. Figured you were playing the other equilibrium, which it turned out that you were. All right? So in this game, there were three subgame perfect equilibria, one for each of the Nash equilibria and the subgame, as it turned out. There was one in which Jake sent them, and they coordinated on the pure strategy equilibrium in the game SS. There was one in which Jake sent them, and they coordinated on the pure strategy equilibrium in the subgame GG. And there's one in which Jake didn't send them, but had he in fact sent them, they would have both mixed, and hence, for a lot of the time, failed to coordinate. All right? And what's the big lesson here? Right, the big lesson of the first game we saw this morning was that subgame perfect equilibrium implies backward induction. Right? The big lesson of this game, other than the fact that we're getting closer to getting Dave and Nina on their date, the big lesson of this game is to show that to find subgame perfect equilibria, all you have to do is keep your head and solve out the Nash equilibria in each of the subgames, roll the payoffs back up, and then look for behavior up the tree. Right, once again, you look for the Nash equilibria in each of these subgames, roll the payoffs back up, and then see what the optimal moves are higher up the tree. All right. So we have time to do one more example. All right. And the third example I want to do is more of an application. All right, so far we've seen some fairly simple examples. Now I want to do an application. And the application I want to do is kind of a classic business school case, if you like, or mini case, involving strategic investment. All right, and the game is this, or the setting is this. There are two firms, we'll call them A and B, and these two firms, initially, before we start considering considering what we're actually going to talk about, initially, they are playing corno competition. So two firms, and they're playing corno competition. And we can imagine that they're producing fertilizer. Right? Imagine that they're producing fertilizer. All right? And let's be specific here. Let's assume that the prices in this market are given by the following demand curve, 2 minus 1/3 times QA plus QB. All right, so this is the demand curve that they face. All right, and we'll assume that costs, marginal costs, C is equal to $1 a ton. All right, so this is the price in dollars per ton, price per ton in dollars. And the costs are $1 per ton, right? And in a minute, what we're going to do is we're going to consider a change in this game. But before we do that, let's just remind ourselves what the corno equilibrium of this game would look like. All right, let's do a bit of a review. All right, so it's a while since we've seen corno, so let's remind ourselves. So I claim that the corno quantity chosen, Q star, has the formula A minus C over 3b. Is that right? Right. If you go back in your notes, you'll find it. So and I'm not going to resolve it here. We've done it many times. So a minus c minus 3b, trust me, is what came out of our calculation before the midterm. And what I want to do is, I just want to make sure we can translate that into numbers here. It's all we're all having in letters, but let's translate it into numbers. So in particular, this a is this 2. Is that right? This C is this 1, and this B is this 1/3. Is that right? So let's just put that down. So what in this case, this is 2 minus 1 over 3 times a 1/3. Right? 2 minus 1 times 3 minus a 1/3. So this says that the quantity is 1, and this is a million tons, so the quantity here, the corno quantity, is a million tons each, right? So 1 each. So each, in this equilibrium, each of these two firms is producing a million tons of fertilizer. All right? And what else do we know? We know, therefore, what prices must be. Let's just do that before we even get started. So prices must be 2 minus 1/3 times the quantity that the first firm produces plus the quantity that the second firm produces. So that's 2 minus 2/3. So that should be 4/3, if I've got that right, or 1 1/3. So prices here are $1.33 per ton. All right? And finally, profits. So profit for each firm here in this equilibrium, before we even start the game, start the more interesting part of the game, profit is what? So they're going to get $1 1/3 for every ton they produce. It's going to cost them $1 to produce each ton, and they're producing 1 million of these things. All right? So their profits are, should be a dollar sign here as well, their profits are 1/3, if these are millions, they're producing 1/3, their profits are 1/3 of $1 million. All right, so this is their per period profit, right? In each period they're doing this. Each year they're doing this, and this is their profits in each period. All right, so this is a simple model that we've done many times before. This is Cournot, and now we're going to make it more interesting. Everything, if the algebra here was a bit quick, don't worry about it. Check it at home. It's just basic algebra. All right, so now suppose that you are the manager of firm A. All right, this is a classic business school case. I'm looking up at my business school students in the balcony. All right, you're the manager of firm A, and you have to choose whether to accept an offer to rent a new machine. All right, so this new machine has two features. All right, three features. The first feature is it only works for A. All right, so this machine is being offered to you. It wouldn't fit in to firm B's technology. So this is only being offered for A. The second feature of this machine is it costs 0.7 million dollars in rental. So each year you rent this machine, you'd have to pay 0.7 million dollars. All right? But that's the bad news. The good news is it will lower A's costs to 50 cents a ton. All right, so classic business school situation. You're the manager of a firm, you're involved in competition with another firm, B, and suddenly an opportunity comes along to rent some new technology. It's going to cost you 0.7 a year to rent this machine, but it will lower your costs by 50 cents a ton. All right, so this is a classic thing that you might be asked in your interview for Morgan Stanley next week. How many of you are interviewing with investment banks? No one's going to admit it. In a couple of years when you're interviewing with these guys. All right, so what's the obvious question? The obvious question is, should you go ahead and rent this new technology or not? Should you rent it or not? To rent or not to rent? To rent or not to rent? All right, less dramatic than its equivalent question in the English class, but important nevertheless. All right, this board is stuck, unfortunately, so I'll have to raise that a bit more. There we go. All right, so what I want to do is I want to analyze this three times. And each time I analyze it, I want us to see what I'm doing, what mistakes I'm making. Because I want you guys, when you interview with Morgan Stanley about this kind of thing, to impress them so that they tell lots of people to come to Yale and preferably give lots of money to Yale. All right, so we're going to look at this way three different times. And the first way we're going to look at this is look at it as if we were accountants. We're going to look at the accountant's answer to this question. And some of you may decide you don't want to interview with Morgan Stanley or McKinsey. You might want to interview with some accounting firm when you leave Yale. God forbid, but you might. All right, so let's have a look at how the accountants would answer this question. All right, so I think the accountants would do this. They would say, "Oh, before we do this, let's have a poll. How many people think you should rent?" You've got time to think about it now. So how many people think you should rent the new machine? And how many people think you should not rent the new machine? Oh, I'm not going to allow abstentions here. Let's try it again. All right, without no abstentions, right? You can't abstain in an interview. All right, so you're on the spot. You're in the boardroom. All right, how many think you should rent the new machine? Raise your hands, wave them in the air. How many people think you should not rent the new machine? All right, so we're split kind of down the middle. I'm looking at my MBA students, see which they voted. Which did you guys vote, rent or not vote? Rent, okay, the MBA students think rent, so we'll see if that's right. All right, so let's move forward. All right, so accountant's answer. So I think what the accountant's gonna say is this. They're gonna say, right now you're producing 1 million tons a year. All right, the new machine saves you a year. Let's have to put per annum. Let's try and be fancy here. So 1 million tons per annum. The new machine saves you 50 cents per ton. So if you rent this new machine, you're producing 1 million tons a year. It's going to save you 50 cents a ton. So it's going to save you $1 million a year in variable cost. Right, those people who earn 115 or 150 know what I mean by variable cost. It's the cost you're going to save in the actual production of your fertilizer. So it saves you $500,000 a year. Right? Unfortunately, it costs you cost of machine, which is a fixed cost, has a fixed cost of 0.7 million a year. Right? And 0.7 is bigger than 0.5, so you should not rent. All right? So 0.5 is less than 0.7, so don't rent the machine. Right? How many of you said no? Was this kind of the back of the envelope calculation you were doing? Is that right? Right? It's kind of back of the envelope calculation that accountants do. So what's going on here? Now, our business school student up in the balcony says you should rent. He took accounting. I know he did that because you have to take accounting at business school. So what's wrong? Did he fail accounting, or is this answer wrong? The answer is wrong. Right, there's two things you need to know about accountants. One is that they're usually boring, and the other is that they're often wrong. Right? They're more often boring than wrong, but they're almost always boring. But all right. So this answer is kind of boring, right? And it happens also to be wrong. Why is it wrong? It's wrong because we made an assumption here that's not a good assumption. We made the assumption that you're going to go on producing the same amount per year after you've invested in the new machine that lowers marginal costs as you are producing beforehand. All right? All right? We made the assumption that it would lower your, we know it lowers your costs, and we assumed implicitly you'd go on producing 1 million tons a year. But that's not right. So let's try and have a more sophisticated answer. And if you want to be more sophisticated and less boring than accounting, what class would you want to take? Economics, probably, right? All right, so let's have a look at an economics answer. Let's look at an economics 115 answer. How many of you have taken economics 115? How many are in 115 at the moment? Quite a few, okay. So let's have a look at the economics answer. Let's see why that previous answer was wrong. So here is QA, and here is cost of a dollar. Your new cost will be 50 cents. All right, so I'm putting prices and costs on this axis. All right, and here is your residual demand curve. This is the demand curve you face after the other guy has finished producing. So this is your residual demand curve. It's the demand curve on that part of the market you're supplying, or not being supplied by the other side of the market. And to figure out your optimal quantity on your residual demand curve, what you should do, it's like you're a monopolist on this residual demand curve, so you should set what? Yeah, say it again, shout out. Yeah, if the answer isn't backward induction, it's probably marginal revenue equals marginal cost, right? So let's try that. So here's the marginal revenue curve, right? Roughly speaking, it should be twice as steep. This is residual marginal revenue, all right? And here's what you used to produce, right? So we know what this is. This was 1 million tons, right? This was marginal revenue hitting marginal cost. Now your costs have gone down. So notice that your quantity, your new quantity, has gone up. Your new quantity has gone up because you've slid down the marginal revenue curve as the marginal cost curve dropped. Is that clear to everybody? All right. So this is the kind of picture that you probably saw a lot of in 115. Is that right? Or in 150, for that matter. Is that correct? So notice in this picture, we can actually see the accountant's answer, the boring answer. The boring answer is this rectangle. Right? This rectangle, this is the accounting answer. This rectangle is 0.5 times 1. So it comes out as a half. And that was the accountant's answer. And what did they miss? What did the accountants miss? They missed the triangle, right? They missed the triangle. They missed this triangle. So I told you they were boring. They're a little bit square, so they tend to miss triangles. All right? So here's the triangle that they missed. All right? So we missed this triangle. All right? And how big is this triangle? Well, we could do it at home. It's half base times height. All right? So we could figure this out. We know the slope of this line. We know the slope of this line is a third. We know the slope of this line is two-thirds. We know that the height of this triangle is a half. We could figure out what the width is as well, therefore, we could do half base times height. Turns out that this has area. I did this at home, so let me just write it down. It has area 3/16. All right? So again, everyone could figure out the area of a triangle at home, is that right? You all know that from your probably junior high school geometry. So assume I did it correctly at home, this is 3/16, which is approximately 0.19. Right, so we missed this 0.19. We missed this 0.19. All right, so how are we doing now? So we know from the accounting answer, we had a half in savings. We know from the economics answer that we should add another 0.19 to this, that's the triangle, for a total of 0.69. But unfortunately, this is still less than 0.7, which is the cost of the machine, the per annum cost of the machine. So it looks like we should still not rent. So even after taking Economics 115, which is a good thing to do and is much less boring than accounting, and we'll get you the accounting answer anyway if you do things carefully, we still end up concluding you shouldn't rent. But our guy from the business school said you should rent, right? So did he fail economics as well as accounting? Or is this answer wrong? This answer's still wrong. This answer's still wrong. Oh, where's a ton? Okay. All right. There we go. I think that board is broken. All right, this answer's still wrong. Didn't really want to delete that. That's a shame. Well, I've done it now. All right. You've all got those numbers somewhere. I hope they're in my notes. This answer is still wrong. We need to get the right answer. All right? So what we need is a third answer, which is the game theory answer, which is also known as the right answer. All right. What are we missing? What's wrong with the economics answer? Somebody. What's wrong? Everyone knew it was wrong. Why is it wrong? It looked pretty good. What's wrong with it? What's wrong with it? Let's bounce down here. I've got somebody in the front row will help me. Why is this? What did I do wrong?
Firm B also changes its quantity.
Right, we assumed, not only in the accounting answer, we assumed that firm A kept its quantity fixed, that we kept our quantity fixed, and that was wrong. But in addition, firm B is going to change its quantity, isn't it? Firm B is going to change its quantity. Let's remind ourselves why. We're still playing Cournot competition. Here's our Cournot diagram with QA and QB. So prior to making this investment, the model is symmetric. Here it is. And this is the old best response of firm A. And this is the best response of firm B. All right? And what we've learned, what we learned just now in the economics answer, is what? We learned that firm A, as its costs go down, will produce more for each possible quantity that firm B produces. So regardless of what generated this residual demand curve, as the costs go down for firm A, it increases its quantity. Right? So we know that. We know that. So what's that telling us? It's telling us that the new best response of firm A is shifted to the right. This is the new best response of firm A. It shifts to the right. It now produces more for any given quantity that firm B produces. All right? So QA has gone up. That was our economics answer. All right? But that leads firm B to do what? To produce less. That leads to QB producing less. Notice we slid down firm B's best response line from the old equilibrium to the new equilibrium. And at the new equilibrium, firm B's production has gone down. How, by the way, what kind of game is it where as firm A increases its strategy, firm B decreases its strategy in response? Strategic substitutes, right? So because this is a game of strategic substitutes, good interview word, right? Good word to mention in an interview. Because this is a game of strategic substitutes, we know that firm B reduces its quantity. As firm B reduces its quantity, is that good for A or bad for A? It's good for A, right? This is good for A. This is good for firm A. It softens competition, right? It softens competition, right? And as a consequence, it leads to an increase in profit. We don't have time today, but what we could do is we could go back and we could recalculate the new Cournot equilibrium, right? We could calculate this. We could, as a homework exercise, try it, calculate the new Nash equilibrium, and notice this is a Nash equilibrium in a subgame. All right? Why is this a subgame? Because firm A made its decision whether to buy this new machine or not, and then they played Cournot. So the Cournot game, the game up here, what is this? This is the subgame. Right? This is the diagram of the subgame, if you like. All right? It's the best response. It's the best responses in the subgame. So what subgame perfection tells us to do here is, first of all, work out the new equilibrium in the subgame, work out how much that new equilibrium is worth for firm A, and then roll it back to the investment decision. Right? It turns out when we do that, we get an extra $0.31 million. All right, so we can do it at home. We get an extra $0.31 million. So it turns out that our MBA student was right, good. All right. It turns out that if you add this 0.31 to the 0.69 we had already, we get 1, which of course is much bigger than 0.7, and indeed you should rent the machine. All right. Now I want you to have two takeaway lessons from this game. The first takeaway lesson is this. When you're analyzing a game like this, be it in the real world or in a job interview, the first thing you want to do is what? You want to look at the subgame. You want to look what would happen if you did invest and solve out the new Nash equilibrium in that subgame. Then you want to roll back the value of that subgame back into the initial decision, which is the strategic investment decision, whether to rent this machine or not. All right, so schematically, the game looks like this. Rent or not rent. And in either case, you play Cournot. Right, there's a subgame in each case. In this case, you play symmetric Cournot when you both have the same costs. And here you play asymmetric Cournot, where you have different costs. And the way we analyze this game is, we solve out the symmetric Cournot, we actually did that up front. We now solve out the new equilibrium in this asymmetric Cournot game, this one here, right, this is the old one, and this is the new one. Solve it out, work out how much profit you're gonna get, and roll that back, remembering that it costs you 0.7 million to make this step. So that's the first takeaway lesson. But the second takeaway lesson is more general. So let me just pause and get everyone to wake up again so I make it. The second takeaway lesson is this. What tipped the balance here from the economics answer and the accounting answer were the strategic effects. It was the strategic effects. This was a strategic effect. It was the effect of the other firm or other players changing their behavior. And the most common mistake to make when you're thinking about strategic decisions is what? It's to forget that they're strategic. It's to forget that the other players are going to change their behavior. In this example, the other firm cuts back its production so much as to make that investment profitable. But let me give you two other examples. Example number one, you're designing a tax policy for the US. The dumb way to analyze this is to say, look at what people are doing now, push through the new tax numbers, and act like an accountant and crunch out how much money the government's going to make. Right? Why is that wrong? Because you're forgetting that as you change the tax code, people's behavior changes. Incentives change and people's behavior change. It leads to a mistake in designing the tax code. You need to take into account strategic effects, how behavior changes. Example number two, closer to home. You're designing a new curriculum for Yale. So you change the rules of the curriculum. And when analyzing it, you say, I wouldn't say this, but some people on a committee might say this, under these new rules, if we look at what people used to do, they will now do more of this and less of that, and they'll learn this and learn that. What are you missing? You're missing that students are players, and students change their behavior as you change the curriculum rules. All right? So the biggest lesson of today's class is don't be like an accountant, partly because it's boring and you won't go on your dates, and partly because you'll miss out on these important strategic effects. We'll come back and look at more on Wednesday.